number one fan has just listened to the second time of Skylark of Space. Thank you so very much.
Go tape.
Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
Greetings. So, I'm not going to be doing a proper show today because I've got stuff to do because the Westercon this weekend, right? I am departing tomorrow in less than 24 hours. And, you know, I should probably eat and sleep in that time, too, so there are things that I do have to get done. But I just wanted to remind you, again, if things go well, which is never necessarily a safe assumption, but if things go well, I will be transmitting Saturday, 19 UTC, from the floor of the convention. That, at least, is my goal. We'll see if it happens. We'll also see if it winds up being by microphone and computer, which I'm bringing, or by telephone, which I'm also bringing. We'll see what I can hook up. Anyway, so much for that. Again, I want to remind you that I will be doing a live reading, and it looks like Sunday, 5 p.m. Pacific time, of Moon Prospector by Bill Ellern. Let's see. But, so that's, well, hopefully that goes well. So those are the main things that I wanted to mention before I get up and about and start doing things today. That essentially I've got a space art exhibit and an atomic energy art exhibit, and those are already in Nevada. And then I will have a couple of display tables with various materials on them. Really, the star of the show there. Well, there's my levitating moon globe is always a favorite. And if you're asking, levitating moon globe? Yes, levitating moon globe. And the the gimmick with the magnets energized by the first commercial atomic energy in the United States hopefully will be a hit. That's, you know, sort of the scale of thing. So, yeah, if you are coming to Tonopah, Nevada this weekend, I certainly hope to see you there. You can, you know, drop by and say hello. But yeah, the live reading. What can I say about it? Other than that, the convention has a COVID policy which requires masking, and the question was, well, how do I do this with a mask on? I don't think I can, so I'm going to be using a transparent face shield for the reading, and we'll see how well that actually works. I'm really not sure, but I'm going to make the best of it. And, you know, if it works out poorly, I'll just have to do it again sometime. Which is not the worst conceivable hardship. But yeah, it's gonna be repeats until at least on Here Now the Words, I think, until at least next Friday, because this Friday and then the following Tuesday, I'm still going to be away and busy, you know, without any time to do much of anything. I keep telling myself I've got to finish editing that Castle of Otranto. Anyway, good news. I may have located a desk chair which would be much more comfortable and supportive than the one I currently have, which has been a continuing obstacle in my efforts to be productive. Oh. And a kind of a nifty thing for me, yesterday, I was over at my storage unit. Yesterday, I was over at my storage unit. Yeah. And, you know, I had to pay my monthly bill before I leave. And I got to talking with the lady there about what I was doing over the weekend. And she said, oh, wow, that sounds really cool. My husband is into science fiction. Anyway, and I mentioned about how I do the readings for this show. And she said, oh, wow, no, you'd never mentioned that before. Anyway, so I gave her one of my cards, and I hope he enjoys things. And who knows, he may start going to science fiction conventions. That would be nifty, I think. They're pretty cool events. And you gotta get people interested enough in them to hold them, or they won't happen, right? I set off a contribution to APA-L, which is a sort of circular fanzine published under the vague and numinous auspices of the Los Angeles Science Fantasy Society. LASFAS used to have their own clubhouse, but they had to leave because of the land was needed for some public improvement or something, and they were going to buy a new building, but then COVID hit. Anyway, I don't know if they ever will have a clubhouse again. A lot of the membership is older, and I don't know, it would be very, very sad to see that go away. I think it's valuable and important and something that we need as part of our culture. Anyway, but I sent off a contribution to the official collator, which is just the, basically the handouts for the two art displays I'm doing. So people will be able, you know, so those handouts, well, I may also post them online at some point. Anyway, I think that is all for me for today. I can't think of anything else that I really need to say. And so I'm gonna drop the stream and turn it back over to the bot while I go about my business. Anyway, y'all have a good week.
Opt in. Go tape.
Here now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on anonradio.net. This is show number 9, covering chapters 4 through 8 of The Moon Pool by Abraham Merritt. The poor copy editing in my paperback finally got to me, and I did what I should have done at the beginning, which is order a copy of the University of Nebraska Press Bison Frontiers of Imagination edition. Now, I didn't mean for this show to become shilling for the University of Nebraska Press, but they do a good job. I'm not going to go back and reread the book, but there may be some supplementary material which can be worked in as fillers at the very least. At the same time, I also ordered a copy of the Bison edition of Skylark of Space by Doc Smith, and assuming that it arrives on time, I will read that on the live stream this coming Sunday, the 26th, and if not, I'll put it off until later. Now, the next one I want to read after that, Auf zwei Planeten, by Kurd Lasswitz, does not have a Bison edition. In fact, its only English edition is an abridgment published in the early 70s by Southern Illinois University Press. And I will say, even as an abridgment, it's pretty huge. So, onward with the purple prose. I actually had to wear purple clothing when reading this. The author certainly doesn't shrink from trying to describe the indescribable, if only by piling on ever more adjectives and adverbs, and he seems never to have met an allusion that he didn't like. I almost want to think that if Hemingway had written this, it would be only a few pages long. And once again, I have to apologize for both dialect and singing. Chapter 5. Into the Moon Pool.
Goodwin, Throckmorton went on at last, I can describe him only as a thing of living light. He radiated light, was filled with light, overflowed with it. A shining cloud whirled through and around him in radiant swirls, shimmering tentacles, luminescent, coruscating spirals. His face shone with a rapture too great to be borne by living man, and was shadowed with insuperable misery. It was as though it had been remolded by the hand of God and the hand of Satan, working together and in harmony. You have seen that seal upon my own, but you have never seen it in the degree that Stanton bore it. The eyes were wide open and fixed, as though upon some inward vision of hell and heaven. The light that filled and surrounded him had a nucleus, a core, something shiftingly human-shaped, that dissolved and changed, gathered itself, whirled through and beyond him and back again. And as its shining nucleus passed through him, Stanton's whole body pulsed radiance. As the luminescence moved, there moved above it, still and serene always, 7 tiny globes of 7 colors, like 7 little moons. Then, swiftly, Stanton was lifted, levitated up to the unscalable wall and to its top. The glow faded from the moonlight. The tinkling music grew fainter. I tried again to move. The tears were running down now from my rigid lids, and they brought relief to my tortured eyes. I have said my gaze was fixed. It was, but from the side peripherally it took in a part of the far wall of the outer enclosure. Ages seemed to pass, and a radiance stole along it. Soon drifted into sight the figure that was Stanton. Far away he was, on the gigantic wall, but still I could see the shining spirals whirling jubilantly around and through him, felt rather than saw his tranced face beneath the seven moons. A swirl of crystal notes, and he had passed, and all the time, as though from some opened well of light, the courtyard gleamed and sent out silver fires that dimmed the moon rays, yet seemed strangely to be part of them. At last the moon neared the horizon. There came a louder burst of sound, the second and last cry of Stanton, like an echo of his first. Again the soft sighing from the inner terrace. Then utter silence. The light faded. The moon was setting, and with a rush, life and power to move returned to me. I made a leap for the steps, rushed up them, through the gateway, and straight to the gray rock. It was closed, as I knew it would be. But did I dream it, or did I hear, echoing through it as though from vast distances, a triumphant shouting? I ran back to Edith. At my touch, she wakened, looked at me wonderingly, raised herself on a hand. "Dave," she said, "I slept, after all." She saw the despair on my face and leapt to her feet. "Dave," she cried, "what is it? Where's Charles?" I lighted a fire before I spoke. Then I told her, and for the balance of that night we sat before the flames, arms around each other, like two frightened children. Abruptly, Throckmorton held his hands out to me appealingly. "Walter, old friend," he cried, "don't look at me as though I were mad. It's truth, absolute truth. Wait!" I comforted him as well as I could. After a little time he took up his story. "Never," he said, "did man welcome the sun as we did that morning. As soon as it had risen, we went back to the courtyard. The walls whereon I had seen Stanton were black and silent. The terraces were as they had been. The gray slab was in its place. In the shallow hollow at its base was nothing. Nothing. Nothing was there anywhere on the islet of Stanton. Not a trace." What were we to do? Precisely the same arguments that had kept us there the night before held good now, and doubly good. We could not abandon these two, could not go as long as there was the faintest hope of finding them. And yet, for love of each other, how could we remain? I loved my wife, how much I never knew until that day, and she loved me as deeply. "It only takes one each night," she pleaded. "Beloved, let it take me." I wept, Walter. We both wept. "We will meet it together," she said, and it was thus that we arranged it. "That took great courage indeed, Throckmorton," I interrupted. He looked at me eagerly. "You do believe, then?" he exclaimed. "I believe," I said. He pressed my hand with a grip that nearly crushed it. "Now," he told me, "I do not fear. If I fail, will you follow with help?" I promised. "We talked it over carefully," he went on, "bringing to bear all our power of analysis and habit of calm scientific thought. We considered minutely the time element in the phenomena. Although the deep chanting began at the very moment of moonrise, fully 5 minutes had passed between its full lifting and the strange sighing sound from the inner terrace. I went back in memory over the happenings of the night before. At least 10 minutes had intervened between the first heralding sigh and the intensification of the moonlight in the courtyard, and this glow grew for at least 10 minutes more before the first burst of the crystal notes. Indeed, more than half an hour must have elapsed, I calculated, between the moment the moon showed above the horizon and the first delicate onslaught of the tinklings. "Edith!" I cried. "I think I have it! The gray rock opens 5 minutes after upon the moonrise, but whoever or whatever it is that comes through it must wait until the moon has risen higher, or else it must come from a distance. The thing to do is not to wait for it, but to surprise it before it passes out the door. We will go into the inner court early. You will take your rifle and pistol and hide yourself where you can command the opening, if the slab does open. The instant it opens, I will enter. It's our best chance, Edith. I think it's our only one." My wife demurred strongly. She wanted to go with me. But I convinced her that it was better for her to stand guard without, prepared to help me if I were forced again into the open by what lay behind the rock. At the half hour before moonrise, we went into the inner court. I took my place at the side of the gray rock. Edith crouched behind a broken pillar 20 feet away, slipped her rifle barrel over it so that it would cover the opening. The minutes crept by. The darkness lessened, and through the breaches of the terrace I watched the far sky softly lighten. With the first pale flush, the silence of the place intensified. It deepened, became unbearably expectant. The moon rose, showed the quarter, the half, then swam up into full sight like a great bubble. Its rays fell upon the wall before me, and suddenly upon the convexities I have described, seven little circles of light sprang out. They gleamed, glimmered, grew brighter, shone. The gigantic slab before me glowed with them. Silver wavelets of phosphorescence pulsed over its surface, and then it turned as though on a pivot, sighing softly as it moved. With a word to Edith, I flung myself through the opening. A tunnel stretched before me. It glowed with the same faint silvery radiance. Down it I raced. The passage turned abruptly, passed parallel to the walls of the outer courtyard, and then once more led downward. The passage ended. Before me was a high vaulted arch. It seemed to open into space, a space filled with lambent, coruscating, many-colored mist, whose brightness grew even as I watched. I passed through the arch and stopped in sheer awe. In front of me was a pool. It was circular, perhaps 20 feet wide. Around it ran a low, softly curved lip of glimmering silvery stone. Its water was palest blue. The pool, with its silvery rim, was like a great blue eye staring upward. Upon it streamed seven shafts of radiance. They poured down upon the blue eye like cylindrical torrents. They were like shining pillars of light rising from a sapphire floor. One was the tender pink of the pearl, one the aurora's green, a third a deathly white, the fourth the blue and mother of pearl, a shimmering column of pale amber, a beam of amethyst, a shaft of molten silver. Such are the colors of the seven lights that stream upon the moon pool. I drew closer, awe-stricken. The shafts did not illumine the depths. They played upon the surface, and seemed there to diffuse, to melt into it. The pool drank them! Through the water tiny gleams of phosphorescence began to dart, sparkles and coruscations of pale incandescence, and far, far below I sensed a movement, a shifting glow as of a radiant body slowly rising. I looked upward, following the radiant pillars to their source. Far above were seven shining globes, and it was from these that the rays poured. Even as I watched, their brightness grew. They were like seven moons set high in some caverned heaven. Slowly their splendor increased, and with it the splendor of the seven beams streaming from them. I tore my gaze away and stared at the pool. It had grown milky, opalescent. The rays gushing into it seemed to be filling it. It was alive with sparklings, scintillations, glimmerings, and the luminescence I had seen rising from its depths was larger, nearer. A swirl of mist floated up from its surface. It drifted within the embrace of the rosy beam and hung there for a moment. The beam seemed to embrace it, sending through it little shining corpuscles, tiny rosy spiralings. The mist absorbed the rays, was strengthened by them, gained substance. Another swirl sprang into the amber shaft, clung and fed there, moved swiftly toward the first and mingled with it. And now other swirls arose, here and there, too fast to be counted, hung poised in the embrace of the light streams, flashed and pulsed into each other. Thicker and thicker still they arose, until over the surface of the pool was a pulsating pillar of opalescent mist, steadily growing stronger, drawing within it life from the seven beams falling upon it, drawing to it from below the darting incandescent atoms of the pool. Into its center was passing the luminescence rising from the far depths, and the pillar glowed, throbbed, began to send out questing swirls and tendrils. There, forming before me, was that which had walked with Stanton, which had taken Thora, the thing I had come to find. My brain sprang into action. My hand threw up the pistol, and I fired shot after shot into the shining core. As I fired, it swayed and shook, gathered again. I slipped a second clip into the automatic, and another idea coming to me, took careful aim at one of the globes in the roof. From thence, I knew, came the force that shaped this dweller in the pool. From the pouring rays came its strength. If I could destroy them, I could check the forming. I fired again and again. If I hit the globes, I did no damage. The little motes in their beams danced with the motes in the mist, troubled. That was all. But up from the pool, like little bells, like tiny bursting bubbles of glass, swarmed the tinkling sounds, their pitch higher, all their sweetness lost. Angry. And out from the inexplicable swept a shining spiral. It caught me above the heart, wrapped itself around me. There rushed through me a mingled ecstasy and horror. Every atom of me quivered with delight and shrank with despair. There was nothing loathsome in it, but it was as though the icy soul of evil and the fiery soul of good had stepped together within me. The pistol dropped from my hand. So I stood while the pool gleamed and sparkled. The streams of light grew more intense, and the radiant thing that held me gleamed and strengthened. Its shining core had a shape, but a shape that my eyes and brain could not define. It was as though a being of another sphere should assume what it might of human semblance, but was not able to conceal that what human eyes saw was but a part of it. It was neither man nor woman. It was unearthly and androgynous. Even as I found its human semblance, it changed, and still the mingled rapture and terror held me. Only in a little corner of my brain dwelt something untouched, something that held itself apart and watched. Was it the soul? I have never believed. And yet, over the head of the misty body there sprang suddenly out 7 little lights. Each was the color of the beam beneath which it rested. I knew now that the dweller was complete. I heard a scream. It was Edith's voice. It came to me that she had heard the shots and followed me. I felt every faculty concentrate into a mighty effort. I wrenched myself free from the gripping tentacle, and it swept back. I turned to catch Edith, and as I did so slipped. Fell. The radiant shape above the pool leapt swiftly, and straight into it raced Edith, arms outstretched to shield me from it. God! She threw herself squarely within its splendor, he whispered. It wrapped its shining self around her. The crystal tinklings burst forth jubilantly. The light filled her, ran through and around her as it had with Stanton, and dropped down upon her face the look. But her rush had taken her to the very verge of the moon pool. She tottered. She fell. With the radiance still holding her, still swirling and winding around and through her, into the moon pool. She sank, and with her went the dweller. I dragged myself to the brink. Far down was a shining, many-colored, nebulous cloud descending. Out of it peered Edith's face, disappearing. Her eyes stared up at me, and she vanished. Edith! I cried again. Edith, come back to me! And then a darkness fell upon me. I remember running back through the shimmering corridors and out into the courtyard. Reason had left me. When I returned, I was far out at sea in our boat, wholly estranged from civilization. A day later I was picked up by the schooner in which I came to Port Moresby. I have formed a plan. You must hear it, Goodwin. He fell upon his berth. I bent over him. Exhaustion and the relief of telling his story had been too much for him. He slept like the dead. All that night I watched over him. When dawn broke, I went to my room to get a little sleep myself, but my slumber was haunted. The next day the storm was unabated. Throckmorton came to me at lunch. He had regained much of his old alertness. "Come to my cabin," he said. There he stripped his shirt from him. "Something is happening," he said. "The mark is smaller." It was as he said. "I'm escaping," he whispered jubilantly. "Just let me get to Melbourne safely, and then we'll see who'll win. For Walter, I'm not at all sure that Edith is dead, as we know death, nor that the others are. There is something outside experience there, some great mystery." And all that day he talked to me of his plans. "There's a natural explanation, of course," he said. "My theory is that the moon rock is of some composition sensitive to the action of moon rays, somewhat as the metal selenium is to sun rays. The little circles over the top are, without doubt, its operating agency. When the light strikes them, they release the mechanism that opens the slab, just as you can open doors with sun or electric light, by an ingenious arrangement of selenium cells. Apparently it takes the strength of a full moon, both to do this and to summon the dweller in the pool. We will first try a concentration of the rays of the waning moon upon these circles to see whether that will open the rock. If it does, we will be able to investigate the pool without interruption from what emanates. Look, here on the chart are their locations. I have made this in duplicate for you in the event of something happening to me. And if I lose, you'll come after us, Goodwin, with help, won't you? And again I promised. A little later he complained of increasing sleepiness. "But it's just weariness," he said. "Not at all like that other drowsiness. It's an hour till moonrise still," he yawned at last. "Wake me up a good 15 minutes before." He lay upon the berth. I sat thinking. I came to myself with a guilty start. I had completely lost myself in my deep preoccupation. What time was it? I looked at my watch and jumped to the porthole. It was full moonlight. The orb had been up for fully half an hour. I strode over to Throckmorton and shook him by the shoulder. "Up, quick, man!" I cried. He rose sleepily. His shirt fell open at the neck, and I looked in amazement at the white band around his chest. Even under the electric light it shone softly, as though little flecks of light were in it. Throckmorton seemed only half awake. He looked down at his breast, saw the glowing cincture, and smiled. "Yes," he said drowsily, "it's coming to take me back to Edith. Well, I'm glad." "Throckmorton!" I cried. "Wake up! Fight!" "Fight," he said. "No use. Come after us." He went to the port and sleepily drew aside the curtain. The moon traced a broad path of light straight to the ship. Under its rays, the band round his chest gleamed brighter and brighter, shot forth little rays, seemed to writhe. The lights went out in the cabin, evidently also throughout the ship, for I heard shoutings above. Throckmorton still stood at the open port. Over his shoulder I saw a gleaming pillar racing along the moon path toward us. Through the window cascaded a blinding radiance. It gathered Throckmorton to it, clothed him in a robe of living opalescence. Light pulsed through and from him. The cabin filled with murmurings. A wave of weakness swept over me, buried me in blackness. When consciousness came back, the lights were again burning brightly. But of Throckmorton there was no trace. Chapter 6. The Shining Devil Took Them. My colleagues of the Association, and you others who may read this narrative, for what I did and did not when full realization returned, I must offer here, briefly as I can, an explanation, a defense, if you will. My first act was to spring to the open port. The coma had lasted hours, for the moon was now low in the west. I ran to the door to sound the alarm. It resisted under my frantic hands, would not open. Something fell tinkling to the floor. It was the key, and I remembered then that Throckmorton had turned it before we began our vigil. With memory, a hope died that I had not known was in me, the hope that he had escaped from the cabin, found refuge elsewhere on the ship. And as I stooped, fumbling with shaking fingers for the key, a thought came to me that drove again the blood from my heart, held me rigid. I could sound no alarm on the Southern Queen for Throckmorton. Conviction of my appalling helplessness was complete. The ensemble of the vessel, from captain to cabin boy, was, to put it conservatively, average. None, I knew, save Throckmorton and myself, had seen the first apparition of the Dweller. Had they witnessed the second? I did not know, nor could I risk speaking, not knowing. And not seeing, how could they believe? They would have thought me insane, or worse, even, it might be, his murderer. I snapped off the electrics, waited and listened, opened the door with infinite caution, and slipped unseen into my own stateroom. The hours until the dawn were eternities of waking nightmare. Reason, resuming sway at last, steadied me. Even had I spoken and been believed, where, in these wastes, after all the hours, could we search for Throckmorton? Certainly the captain would not turn back to Port Moresby, and even if he did, of what use for me to set forth for the Nan Matal without the equipment which Throckmorton himself had decided was necessary, if one hoped to cope with the mystery that lurked there? There was but one thing to do. Follow his instructions, get the paraphernalia in Melbourne or Sydney if it were possible. If not, sail to America as swiftly as might be, secure it there, and as swiftly return to Penape. And this I determined to do. Calmness came back to me after I had made this decision, and when I went up on deck I knew that I had been right. They had not seen the Dweller. They were still discussing the darkness of the ship, talking of dynamos burned out, wires short-circuited, a half dozen explanations of the extinguishment. Not until noon was Throckmorton's absence discovered. I told the captain that I had left him early in the evening, that indeed I knew him but slightly after all. It occurred to none to doubt me, or to question me minutely. Why should it have? His strangeness had been noted, commented upon. All who had met him had thought him half mad. I did little to discourage the impression. And so it came naturally that on the log it was entered that he had fallen or leapt from the vessel sometime during the night. A report to this effect was made when we entered Melbourne. I slipped quietly ashore, and in the press of the War News, Throckmorton's supposed fate won only a few lines in the newspapers. My own presence on the ship and in the city passed unnoticed. I was fortunate in securing at Melbourne everything I needed except a set of Becquerel ray condensers, but these were the very keystone of my equipment. Pursuing my search to Sydney, I was doubly fortunate in finding a firm who were expecting these very articles in a consignment due them from the States within a fortnight. I settled down in strictest seclusion to await their arrival. And now it will occur to you to ask why I did not cable, during this period of waiting, to the Association, demand aid from it, or why I did not call upon members of the university staffs of either Melbourne or Sydney for assistance. At the least, why I did not gather, as Throckmorton had hoped to do, a little force of strong men to go with me to the Nan Matal. To the first two questions I answered frankly, I did not dare. And this reluctance, this inhibition, every man jealous of his scientific reputation will understand. The story of Throckmorton, the happenings I had myself witnessed, were incredible, abnormal, outside the facts of all known science. I shrank from the inevitable disbelief, perhaps ridicule, Nay, perhaps even the graver suspicion that had caused me to seal my lips while on the ship. Why, I myself could only half believe. How then could I help to convince others? And as for the third question, I could not take men into the range of such a peril without first warning them of what they might encounter, and if I did warn them, it was checkmate. If it was also cowardice, well, I have atoned for it, but I do not hold it so. My conscience is clear. That fortnight and the greater part of another passed before the ship I awaited steamed into port. By that time, between my straining anxiety to be after Throckmorton, the despairing thought that every moment of delay might be vital to him and his, and my intensely eager desire to know whether that shining, glorious horror on the moon path did exist, or had been hallucination, I was worn almost to the edge of madness. At last the condensers were in my hands. It was more than a week later, however, before I could secure passage back to Port Moresby, and it was another week still before I started north on the Suwarna, a swift little sloop with a 50-horsepower auxiliary, heading straight for Ponape and the Nan Matal. We sighted the Brunhilde, some 500 miles south of the Carolines. The wind had fallen soon after Papua had dropped astern. The Suwarna's ability to make her 12 knots an hour without it had made me very fully forgive her for not being as fragrant as the Javan flower for which she was named. Da Costa, her captain, was a garrulous Portuguese. His mate was a Canton man with all the marks of long and able service on some pirate junk. His engineer was a half-breed Chino-Malay who had picked up his knowledge of power plants, heaven alone knew where, and, I had reason to believe, had transferred all his religious impulses to the American-built deity of mechanism he so faithfully served. The crew was made up of 6 huge, chattering Tonga boys. The Suwarna had cut through Finschaffenhuon Gulf to the protection of the Bismarcks. She had threaded the maze of the archipelago tranquilly, and we were then rolling over the 1,000-mile stretch of open ocean, with New Hanover far behind us, and our boat's bow pointed straight toward Nuku'or of the Monteverdes. After we had rounded Nuku'or, we could, barring accident, reach Ponape in not more than 60 hours. It was late afternoon, and on the demure little breeze that marched behind us came far-flung sighs of spice trees and nutmeg flowers. The slow, prodigious swells of the Pacific lifted us in gentle giant hands and sent us, as gently, down the long, blue wave slopes to the next broad upward slope. There was a spell of peace over the ocean, stilling even the Portuguese captain who stood dreamily at the wheel, slowly swaying to the rhythmic lift and fall of the sloop. There came a whining hail from the Tonga boy lookout, draped lazily over the bow. "Sail, he blong portside!" Da Costa straightened and gazed while I raised my glass. The vessel was a scant mile away, and must have been visible long before the sleepy watcher had seen her. She was a sloop about the size of the Suwarna, without power. All sails set, even to a spinnaker she carried, she was making the best of the little breeze. I tried to read her name, but the vessel jibed sharply as though the hands of the man at the wheel had suddenly dropped the helm, and then, with an equal abruptness, swung back to her course. The stern came in sight, and on it I read, "Brunhilde." I shifted my glasses to the man at the wheel. He was crouching down over the spokes in a helpless, huddled sort of way, and even as I looked, the vessel veered again, abruptly as before. I saw the helmsman straighten up and bring the wheel about with a vicious jerk. He stood so for a moment, looking straight ahead, entirely oblivious of us, and then seemed again to sink down within himself. It came to me that his was the action of a man striving vainly against a weariness unutterable. I swept the deck with my glasses. There was no other sign of life. I turned to find the Portuguese staring intently and with puzzled air at the sloop, now separated from us by a scant half mile. "Something very wrong, I think, there, sir," he said in his curious English. "The man on the deck I know. He is captain and owner of the Brunhild. His name Olaf Huldriksson, what do you say, Norwegian. He is either very sick or very tired, but I do not understand where is the crew in the starboard boat is gone." He shouted an order to the engineer, and as he did so the faint breeze failed, and the sails of the Brunhilde flapped down inert. We were now nearly abreast, and a scant 100 yards away. The engine of the Suwarna died, and the Tonga boys leapt to one of the boats. "You Olaf Huldriksson!" shouted Da Costa. "What's the matter with you?" The man at the wheel turned toward us. He was a giant, his shoulders enormous, thick-chested, strength in every line of him. He towered like a Viking of old at the rudder bar of his shark ship. I raised the glass again. His face sprang into the lens, and never have I seen a visage lined and marked as though by ages of unsleeping misery, as was that of Olaf Huldriksson. The Tonga boys had the boat alongside and were waiting at the oars. The little captain was dropping into it. "Wait!" I cried. I ran into my cabin, grasped my emergency medical kit, and climbed down the rope ladder. The Tonga boys bent to the oars. We reached the side, and DaCosta and I each seized a lanyard dangling from the stays and swung ourselves on board. DaCosta approached Huldrickson softly. "What's the matter, Olaf?" he began, and then was silent, looking down at the wheel. The hands of Huldrickson were lashed fast to the spokes by thongs of thin, strong cord. They were swollen and black, and the thongs had bitten into the sinewy wrists till they were hidden in the outraged flesh, cutting so deeply that blood fell, slow drop by drop, at his feet. We sprang toward him, reaching out hands to his fetters to loose them. Even as we touched them, Huldrickson aimed a vicious kick at me, and then another at DaCosta, which sent the Portuguese tumbling into the scuppers. "Let be!" cried Huldrickson. His voice was thick and lifeless, as though forced from a dead throat. His lips were cracked and dry, and his parched tongue was black. "Let be go, let be." The Portuguese had picked himself up, whimpering with rage and knife in hand, but as Huldrickson's voice reached him, he stopped. Amazement crept into his eyes, and he thrust the blade back into his belt. They softened with pity. "Something very wrong with Olaf," he murmured to me. "I think he crazy." And then Olaf Huldrickson began to curse us. He did not speak. He howled from that hideously dry mouth his imprecations, and all the time his red eyes roamed the sea, and his hands, clenched and rigid on the wheel, dripped blood. "I go below," said DaCosta nervously. "His wife, his daughter..." He darted down the companionway and was gone. Huldrickson, silent once more, had slumped down over the wheel. DaCosta's head appeared at the top of the companion steps. "There is nobody, nobody," he paused, then. "Nobody nowhere." His hands flew out in a gesture of hopeless incomprehension. "I do not understand." Then Olaf Huldrickson opened his dry lips, and as he spoke, a chill ran through me, checking my heart. "The sparkling devil took them," croaked Olaf Huldrickson. "The sparkling devil took them. Took my Helma and my little Freda. The sparkling devil came down from the moon and took them." He swayed. Tears dripped down his cheeks. DaCosta moved toward him again, and again Huldrickson watched him, alertly, wickedly, from his bloodshot eyes. I took a hypodermic from my case and filled it with morphine. I drew DaCosta to me. "Get to the side of him," I whispered. "Talk to him." He moved over toward the wheel. "Where is your Helma and your Frida, Olaf?" he said. Huldrickson turned his head toward him. "The shining devil took them," he croaked. "The moon devil that spark..." A yell broke from him. I had thrust the needle into his arm just above one swollen wrist and had quickly shot the drug through. He struggled to release himself and then began to rock drunkenly. The morphine, taking him in his weakness, worked quickly. Soon over his face a piece dropped. The pupils of the staring eyes contracted. Once, twice he swayed, and then, his bleeding, prisoned hands held high and still gripping the wheel, he crumpled to the deck. With utmost difficulty we loosed the thongs, but at last it was done. We rigged a little swing, and the Tonga boys slung the great inert body over the side into the dory. Soon we had Huldrickson in my bunk. DaCosta sent half his crew over to the sloop in charge of the Cantonese. They took in all sail, stripping Huldrickson's boat to the masts, and then with the Brunhilde nosing quietly along after us at the end of a long hawser, one of the Tonga boys at her wheel, we resumed the way so enigmatically interrupted. I cleaned and bandaged the Norseman's lacerated wrists, and sponged the blackened, parched mouth with warm water and a mild antiseptic. Suddenly I was aware of DaCosta's presence, and turned. His unease was manifest, and held, it seemed to me, a queer, furtive anxiety. "What do you think of Olaf, sir?" he asked. I shrugged my shoulders. "You think he killed his woman and his baby?" he went on. "You think he crazy and killed all?" "Nonsense, DaCosta," I answered. "You saw the boat was gone. Most probably his crew mutinied, and to torture him, tied him up the way you saw. They did the same thing with Hilton of the Coral Lady. You'll remember." "No," he said. "No, the crew did not. Nobody there on board when Olaf was tied." "What?" I cried, startled. "What do you mean?" "I mean," he said slowly, "that Olaf tie himself." "Wait!" he went on at my incredulous gesture of dissent. "Wait, I show you." He had been standing with his hands behind his back, and now I saw that he held in them the cut thongs that had bound Huldrickson. They were blood-stained, and each len ended in a broad leather tip, skillfully spliced into the cord. "Look," he said, pointing to these leather ends. I looked and saw in them the deep indentations of teeth. I snatched one of the thongs and opened the mouth of the unconscious man on the bunk. Carefully, I placed the leather within it and gently forced the jaws shut on it. It was true. Those marks were where Olaf Huldrickson's jaws had gripped. "Wait," Da Costa repeated, "I show you." He took other cords and rested his hands on the supports of a chair back. Rapidly, he twisted one of the thongs around his left hand, drew a loose knot, shifted the cord up toward his elbow. This left wrist and hand still free, and with them, he twisted the other cord around the right wrist, drew a similar knot. His hands were now in the exact position that Huldrickson's had been on the Runhilda, but with cords and knots hanging loose. Then Da Costa reached down his head, took a leather end in his teeth, and with a jerk drew the thong that noosed his left hand tight. Similarly, he drew tight the second. He strained at his fetters. There before my eyes he had pinioned himself so that without aid he could not release himself, and he was exactly as Huldrickson had been. "You will have to cut me loose, sir," he said. "I cannot move them. It is an old trick on these seas. Sometimes it is necessary that a man stand at the wheel many hours without help, and he does this so that if he sleep the wheel wake him. Yes, sir." I looked at from him to the man on the bed. "But why, sir," said Da Costa slowly, "did Olaf have to tie his hands?" I looked at him uneasily. "I don't know," I answered. "Do you?" He fidgeted, avoided my eyes, and then rapidly, almost surreptitiously, crossed himself. "No," he replied, "I know nothing. Some things I have heard, but they tell many tales on these seas." He started for the door. Before he reached it, he turned. "But this I do know," he half whispered. "I am damn glad there is no full moon tonight." And passed out, leaving me staring after him in amazement. What did the Portuguese know? I bent over the sleeper. On his face was no trace of that unholy mingling of opposites the dweller stamped upon his victims. And yet, what was it the Norseman had said? "The sparkling devil took them." Nay, he had been even more explicit. "The sparkling devil that came down from the moon." Could it be that the dweller had swept upon the Brunhilde, drawing down the moon path Olaf Huldrickson's wife and babe, even as it had drawn Throckmorton? As I sat thinking, the cabin grew suddenly dark, and from above came a shouting and patter of feet. Down upon us swept one of the abrupt, violent squalls that are met with in these latitudes. I lashed Huldrickson fast in the berth and ran up on deck. The long, peaceful swells had changed into angry, choppy waves, from the tops of which the spindrift streamed in long, stinging lashes. A half hour passed. The squall died as quickly as it had arisen. The sea quieted. Over in the west, from beneath the tattered, flying edge of the storm, dropped the red globe of the setting sun, dropped slowly until it touched the sea rim. I watched, and rubbed my eyes, and stared again, for over its flaming portal something huge and black moved like a gigantic, beckoning finger. Da Costa had seen it too, and he turned the Sawarna straight toward the descending orb and its strange shadow. As we approached, we saw it was a little mass of wreckage, and that the beckoning finger was a wing of canvas, sticking up and swaying with the motion of the waves. On the highest point of the wreckage sat a tall figure calmly smoking a cigarette. We brought the Sawarna to, dropped a boat, and with myself as coxswain, pulled toward a wrecked hydro-airplane. Its occupant took a long puff at his cigarette, waved a cheerful hand, and shouted a greeting, and just as he did so, a great wave raised itself up behind him, took the wreckage, tossed it high in a swelter of foam, and it passed on. Where we had steadied our boat, where wreck and man had been, was nothing. There came a tug at the side, two muscular brown hands gripped it close to my left, and a sleek, black, wet head showed its top between them. Two bright blue eyes that held deep within them a laughing deviltry looked into mine, and a long, lithe body drew itself gently over the thwart and seated its dripping self at my feet. "Much obliged," said the man from the sea. "I knew somebody was sure to come along when the O'Keefe Banshee didn't show up."
"The what?"
I asked in amazement. "The O'Keefe Banshee. I am Larry O'Keefe. It's a far way from Ireland, but it's not too far for the O'Keefe Banshee to travel if the O'Keefe was going to click in." I looked again at my astonishing rescue. He seemed perfectly serious. "Have you a cigarette? Mine went out," he said with a grin, as he reached a moist hand out for the little cylinder, took it, lighted it. I saw a lean, intelligent face whose fighting jaw was softened by the wistfulness of the clean-cut lips and the honesty that lay side by side with the deviltry in the laughing blue eyes, nose of a thoroughbred with a suspicion of a tilt, long, well-knit, slender figure that I knew must have all the strength of fine steel, the uniform of a lieutenant in the Royal Flying Corps of Britain's Navy. He laughed, stretched out a firm hand, and gripped mine. "Thank you really ever so much, old man," he said. "I liked Larry O'Keefe from the beginning, but I did not dream, as the Tonga boys pulled us back to the Suwarna, how that liking was to be forged into man's strong love for man, by fires which souls such as his and mine, and yours who read this, could never dream. Larry! Larry O'Keefe, where are you now, with your leprechauns and banshee, your heart of a child, your laughing blue eyes, and your fearless soul? Shall I ever see you again, Larry O'Keefe, dear to me as some best-beloved younger brother? Larry." Chapter 7. Larry O'Keefe. Pressing back the questions I longed to ask, I introduced myself. Oddly enough, I found that he knew me, or rather my work. He had bought, it appeared, my volume upon the peculiar vegetation whose habit is disintegrating lava, rock, and volcanic ash, that I had entitled, somewhat loosely I could now perceive, Flora of the Craters. For he explained naively that he had picked it up, thinking it an entirely different sort of book, a novel in fact, something like Meredith's Diana of the Crossways, which he liked greatly. He had hardly finished this explanation when we touched the side of the Suwarna, and I was forced to curb my curiosity until we reached the deck. "That thing you saw me sitting on," he said, after he had thanked the bowing little skipper for his rescue, "was all that was left of one of His Majesty's best little hydro-aeroplanes after that cyclone threw it off as excess baggage. And by the way, about where are we?" Da Costa gave him our approximate position from the noon reckoning. O'Keefe whistled. "A good 300 miles from where I left the HMS Dolphin about 4 hours ago," he said. "That squall I rode in on was some whizzer." "The Dolphin," he went on, calmly divesting himself of his soaked uniform, "was on her way to Melbourne. I had been yearning for a joy ride and went up for an alleged scouting trip. Then that blow shot out of nowhere, picked me up, and insisted that I go with it. About an hour ago, I thought I saw a chance to zoom up and out of it. I turned, and blick went my right wing, and down I dropped." "I don't know how we can notify your ship, Lieutenant O'Keefe," I said. "We have no wireless." "Dr. Goodwin," said Da Costa, "we could change our course, sir, perhaps." "Thanks, but not a bit of it," broke in O'Keefe. "Lord alone knows where the Dolphin is now. Fancy she'll be nosing around looking for me. Anyway, she's just as apt to run into you as you into her. Maybe we'll strike something with a wireless, and I'll trouble you to put me aboard." He hesitated. "Where are you bound, by the way?" he asked. "For Panape," I answered. "No wireless there," mused O'Keefe. "Beastly hole. Stopped a week ago for fruit. Natives seemed scared to death at us. Or something. What are you going there for?" Da Costa darted a furtive glance at me. It troubled me. O'Keefe noted my hesitation. "Oh, I beg your pardon," he said. "Maybe I oughtn't to have asked that." "It's no secret, Lieutenant," I replied. "I'm about to undertake some exploration work, a little digging among the ruins on the Nan Matal." I looked at the Portuguese sharply as I named the place. A pallor crept beneath his skin, and again he made swiftly the sign of the cross, glancing, as he did so, fearfully to the north. I made up my mind, then, to question him when opportunity came. He turned from his quick scrutiny of the sea and addressed O'Keefe. "There's nothing on board to fit you, Lieutenant." "Oh, just give me a sheet to throw me around me, Captain," said O'Keefe, and followed him. Darkness had fallen, and as the two disappeared into Da Costa's cabin, I slowly opened the door of my own and listened. Huldrickson was breathing deeply and regularly. I drew my electric flash, and shielding its rays from my face, looked at him. His sleep was changing from the heavy stupor of the drug into one that was at least on the borderland of the normal. The tongue had lost its arid blackness, and the mouth secretions had resumed action. Satisfied as to his condition, I returned to deck. O'Keefe was there, looking like a specter in the cotton sheet he had wrapped around him. A deck table had been cleated down, and one of the Tonga boys was setting it for our dinner. Soon, the very creditable larder of the Suwarna dressed the board, and O'Keefe, Da Costa, and I attacked it. The night had grown close and oppressive. Behind us, the forward light of the Brunhilde glided, and the binnacle lamp threw up a faint glow in which her black helmsman's face stood out mistily. O'Keefe had looked curiously a number of times at our tow, but had asked no questions. "You're not the only passenger we picked up today," I told him. "We found the captain of that sloop lashed to his wheel, nearly dead with exhaustion, and his boat deserted by everyone except himself." "What was the matter?" asked O'Keefe in astonishment. "We don't know," I answered. "He fought us, and I had to drug him before we could get him loose from his lashings." He's sleeping down in my berth now. His wife and little girl ought to have been on board, the captain here says, but they weren't. "Wife and child gone!" exclaimed O'Keefe. From the condition of his mouth, he must have been alone at the wheel and without water at least 2 days and nights before we found him. And as for looking for anyone on these waters after such a time, it's hopeless. "That's true," said O'Keefe. "But his wife and baby, poor, poor devil." He was silent for a time, and then at my solicitation began to tell us more of himself. He had been little more than 20 when he had won his wings and entered the war. He had been seriously wounded at Ypres during the third year of the struggle, and when he recovered, the war was over. Shortly after that, his mother had died. Lonely and restless, he had re-entered the air service and had remained in it ever since. And though the war's long over, I got homesick for the Lark's Land with the German planes playing tunes on their machine guns and their Archies tickling the soles of my feet. He sighed. If you're in love, love to the limit. And if you hate, why, hate like the devil. And if it's a fight you're in, get where it's hottest and fight like hell. If you don't, life's not worth the living, sighed he. I watched him as he talked, feeling my liking for him steadily increasing. If I could but have a man like this beside me, on the path of unknown peril upon which I had set my feet, I thought wistfully. We sat and smoked a bit, sipping the strong coffee the Portuguese made so well. Da Costa at last relieved the Cantonese at the wheel. O'Keefe and I drew up chairs to the rail. The brighter stars shone out dimly through a hazy sky. Gleams of phosphorescence tipped the crests of the waves and sparkled with an almost angry brilliance as the bow of the Suwarna tossed them aside. O'Keefe pulled contentedly at a cigarette. The glowing spark lighted the keen, boyish face and the blue eyes, now black and brooding under the spell of the tropic night. "Are you American or Irish, O'Keefe?" I asked suddenly. "Why?" he laughed. "Because," I answered, "from your name and your service I would suppose you Irish, but your command of pure Americanese makes me doubtful." He grinned amiably. "I'll tell you how that is," he said. "My mother was an American, a Grace of Virginia. My father was the O'Keefe of Coleraine, and these two loved each other so well that the heart they gave me is half Irish and half American. My father died when I was 16. I used to go to the States with my mother every other year for a month or two, but after my father died we used to go to Ireland every other year. And there you are. I'm as much American as I am Irish. When I'm in love, excited or dreaming, or mad, I have the brogue. But for the everyday purposes of life I like the United States talk. And I know Broadway as well as I do Benevena Lane, and the Sound as well as St. Patrick's Channel. Educated a bit at Eton, a bit at Harvard, always too much money to have to make any. In love a lots of times, and never a heartache after that that wasn't a pleasant one. And never a real purpose in life until I took the King's shilling and earned my wings. Something over 30, and that's me, Larry O'Keefe." "But it was the Irish O'Keefe who sat out there waiting for the Banshee," I laughed. "It was that," he said somberly, and I heard the brogue creep over his voice like velvet, and his eyes grew brooding again. "There's never an O'Keefe for these thousand years that has passed without his warning, and twice have I heard the Banshee calling, once when it was my younger brother died, and once when my father lay waiting to be carried out on the ebb tide." He mused a moment, then went on. "And once I saw an Anir Coily, a girl of the green people, flit like a shade of green fire through Carntor woods, and once at Duncraig I slept where the ashes of the Dun of Cormac MacConcobar are mixed with those of Cormac and Aelith the Fair, all burned in the nine flames that sprang from the harping of Crevethin, and I heard the echo of his dead harpings." He paused again, and then, softly, with that curiously sweet high voice that only the Irish seemed to have, he sang, "Woman of the white breasts, Aelith, woman of the gold-brown hair and lips of the red, red rowan, where is the swan that is whiter, with breast more soft, or the wave on the sea that moves as thou movest, Aelith?" Chapter 8. Olaf's Story. There was a little silence. I looked upon him with wonder. Clearly he was in deepest earnest. I know that the psychology of the Gael is a curious one, and that deep in all their hearts their ancient traditions and beliefs have strong and living roots, and here I was, both amused and touched. Here was this soldier, who had faced war and its ugly realities open-eyed and fearless, picking indeed the most dangerous branch of service for his own, a modern if ever there was one, appreciative of most unmystical Broadway, and yet soberly and earnestly.